This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last night we commented about the pasuk v'somachto v'chol atoy v'asher nosan l'cho Hashem l'kecho l'v'esecho, and you shall rejoice with all the good which Hashem has given to you and to your home. And the good to which the Torah is referring to appears to be the material blessing that Bnei Yisrael enjoy after they've come into Eretz Yisrael and they've harvested their fruits and their wine, their vineyards and their oil, and they're actually enjoying their income. That's the Bechol HaTov, which is a strange thing for the Torah to say. An instruction of V'somachto Bechol HaTov. Is that anybody's here? Sure. They've taken it already. It's all right. You can relax now. That you shall have simcha, that you shall enjoy the simcha. What simcha would you think it is that the Torah is talking about? This is not a book on pop psychology and on how to enjoy yourself and how to have pleasure. This is the Torah, Torah Hashem, giving us a mitzvah. The mitzvah here is v'somachto, you shall enjoy. What should you enjoy? You should enjoy Yom Tov, you should enjoy Shabbos, you should enjoy your family and your children. The chol atoiv, all the money that comes rolling in when you're gathering in your harvest. Enjoy it, enjoy it. Kind of a mitzvah is that. Then the parasha goes on to talk about Maaser Sheni, the food that used to be brought, used to sell the Maaser Sheni, and take the money to Yerushalayim and spend it on eating on food in Yerushalayim. And then after these two sections, Hayom Hazeh, it's on this day that Hashem Elokecho Metzavcho La'aseh Esachukim Ho'ele Ve'esamishpotim, that Hashem your God has commanded you to do these laws and these statutes. And you shall do them with all your heart and with all your soul. What's on this day? Is that the day that Moshe is standing before Bnei Israel and talking to them? That's not any special day that Hashem commanded them. Hashem commanded them a long time before. So Hayom Hazeh almost seems to imply, on this day, on the day that you keep these mitzvahs of bringing the Bikurim, Hashem instructs you to do these mitzvahs. Es Hashem he'emarto Hayom. Today you have declared the Ribbono Shel Olam liyus l'chol Elokim, to be your God. What again? What's the today? What day? The day that they're standing there, Moshe's last day of his life, they didn't do anything, they're standing passively. What did they do to declare that Hashem will be their God? So again, we're learning that it doesn't mean that day that Hashem talked to them, but that day that they fulfill these specific mitzvahs, particularly of Bikurim, of bringing their first fruits into the Beis HaMikdosh, that day they declare Hashem to be their God, b'loleches b'drochov, and to go by His way, b'lishmer chukov, b'mitzvesov, b'mishpotov, b'lishmar b'keilov. B'Hashem he'emirecho hayoyim, and Hashem has declared you this day, li'yis lo la'am segulo kasher dibelecho, to be a special nation, as He has spoken to you, b'lishmer chukov, b'mitzvesov, to keep all His mitzvahs, and to make you separate from all the goyim, and so on. And the Gemara says in Brochus and Davov, Es Hashem he'emarto hayoyim, v'Hashem he'emirecho hayoyim. You have made Hashem special, singled Him out today, and Hashem has done the same with you. Om Elohim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael. Hashem says to Yisrael, Atem asisuni chativo achas ba'ilam. You made me into one concept in the world. Ba'ani e'ese eschem chativo achas ba'ilam. And I will make you into one concept in the world. Atem asisuni chativo achas ba'ilom. You made me into one in the world. Shneimar, because it says Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Each time you declare the oneness of Hashem, when you recite Shema Yisrael, you're making Hashem one. Ani eschem chativo achas ba'ilom, and I'll make you one concept in the world. Shneimar, as it says, Umi ka'amcho Yisrael lo echod ba'oretz. Who is like the Jewish people, one nation in the world? That means this Gemara is not telling us two disconnected things, that Hashem is unique and that the Bnei Yisrael is unique. The Gemara is telling us, based on these psukim, that the uniqueness of Bnei Yisrael among the nations is parallel to the uniqueness of the Ribbono Shel Olam among the gods. What it is. Until Avraham Avinu came, what did the people think? That there were gods of evil, and there were gods of good, and there were gods of wealth, and there were gods of fertility, and there were gods of agriculture, and gods of rain, and gods of flood. There were all these dozens and dozens of different kinds of gods, and they all battled with each other, and sometimes the one group won, and sometimes the other group won, and there were all these different forces playing on the world. And Avraham Avinu came along and taught the Achdus Hashem, that there's only one Ribbono Shel Olam. So what is the relationship between Hashem and all the others? What are we going to say that there are all these gods, but Hashem is a better God? That's not what it means. What are we saying that there were all these other gods, but Hashem is a greater God, a more powerful God? Is that what we mean? No, that's not what we mean. What we mean is that there's nothing but the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what it is. When we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echod, we're not saying Hashem is the greatest God. We're not saying Hashem is the finest God, the most noble God, the most powerful God. We're saying Hashem is the only God, there is no other God. And if that's what we mean when we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echod, what does Hashem mean when he says, Umika Amcho Yisrael, Goy Echod Boret? Who is like the Jewish people, one nation in the world? One nation doesn't mean a better nation, a bigger nation, a more powerful nation. Am Echod means the only nation of its kind, there is none other like it. That's what it means. Just as when we make Hashem Echod, we're saying there is nothing else that comes anywhere near Him. There's no species like Him. There is no other being to whom the word God applies. So Hashem is saying there is no group of people to whom the word Am applies. There is no other nation other than the Ribbono Shel Olam, other than the Am Yisrael. What does that mean? Of course there are other nations. So what it means is, as the Kuzari says, that the world is divided up into its four levels. There's the domain, mineral, inanimate objects. And although there are many, many variances within the grouping of domain, there are all the different kinds of minerals and all the different kinds of elements, and the elements combining to form all sorts of different kinds of substances. So there are thousands and thousands, millions probably, of different kinds of substance, but they all form into the group of domain, of inanimate objects. And then there's the group of the tzomeach, vegetation. And there are millions of different types of grasses and of weeds and of flowers and of plants and of trees. Millions of different types all over the world. But they all form one group. They're all tzomeach. They're all vegetation. And then there's chai. There's the animal world. And all the birds that fall into that and all the insects that fall into that and all the animals, the herbivorous animals and the carnivorous animals, all the fish that come into that group, millions and millions of different individual species, of different individual types of chai, but they all form part of the group of chai. And then on top of them all, there's the medabe. There's the being capable of speech, and that's the human being. And there are all sorts of different kinds of human beings and different species and different nations of human beings, but they all share the common fact that they're all part of the group that is Medaber, they're all human. That's what they share in common. And Rebellia spoke about this uniqueness of the Am Yisrael during the opening days of the Second World War. And he said you need to understand what that Kuzari means. What it means is not that each section, that each level has what the other level, what the level before it has, plus one extra. What is a domain? Domain is a mineral thing. So a mineral doesn't grow. It doesn't vegetate. So what is a plant? Is a plant a vegetating mineral? Is a plant a rock that can photosynthesize? That's not what a rock is. That's not what a plant is. The additional quality of vegetation makes a vegetable a completely different bria that has absolutely no connection with that which went before it. There is no evolution from mineral to vegetable. All the different kinds of minerals, maybe they evolved one from another. Maybe all the different kinds of vegetables evolved from one to another. But there was no evolution from mineral to vegetable. Vegetables didn't evolve out of rocks. And what about high animals? The same thing. What is an animal? Is an animal a vegetable that can move? Is an animal a vegetable with legs? Can walk from one place to another or swim from one place to another? Is that what it is? And if you say, in what way is the chai different to the vegetable? In what essential way is the animal different to the vegetable? The animal can move. The vegetable can't move. The animal can move independently. The vegetable can't. Does that mean that an animal is a walking vegetable? Imagine a potato walking around. Is that a cow? Not at all. It's a different thing altogether. The fact that it has that additional feature takes it out of being a vegetable. It doesn't become a sophisticated vegetable. It's no longer a vegetable at all. It's a chai. It's a different species altogether. And no way could it have evolved from the vegetable. That's what it is. And the medaber, the human being, is a human being, an animal that can talk. Bilam's donkey, does he become a human being just because he can talk? It's not like that at all. The fact that he can talk is his distinguishing factor, his distinguishing symptom. But that now that he can talk indicates that just as palm trees don't grow out of rocks and giraffes don't grow out of palm trees, so human beings don't grow out of monkeys. That's a different species altogether. It's not just a monkey that can speak, that's not a human being. That's what Darwin thought a human being was, but that's not what a human being is. A human being is a different grouping that did not evolve from anything else that came before. Different species altogether. But the Khuzri says there's a fifth species. And that's where the world makes the mistake. And that is the fifth species of Am Yisrael. The Jewish people are not and one of the other nations who also have a Torah. That's not what they are. The Jewish people is a different species altogether. Something completely different. And just as their special neshama doesn't make them the same as a non-Jew plus an extra feature is exactly the same as an animal isn't a sophisticated, or a human being isn't a sophisticated animal, and an animal isn't a sophisticated vegetable, and a vegetable isn't a sophisticated mineral, so a Jew isn't a sophisticated human being. It's a different species altogether. And Rebbe explains, if you look at it further and you'll realize, what happens when a vegetable loses its quality of being a vegetable? It can be a vegetable is alive. What happens when a vegetable loses its life? Does it just become a mineral? It doesn't. Because a mineral doesn't decay. When a vegetable loses its life force, it decays, it deteriorates, it becomes much worse than a mineral. And when an animal loses its life, what happens to it? It doesn't just become a vegetable. Imagine if it is just that it would be the opposite of evolution. So when the animal dies, you can plant him in the garden and make an animal tree. It doesn't work like that. When an animal dies, he deteriorates and degenerates and decays, and the smell is even more foul than when a vegetable decays. And what about a human being? When a human being loses his humanity, so on the simple level, on the straightforward sense, when a human being dies, he decays and degenerates even worse than an animal. And it smells even worse than an animal that has died. And on a human sense also, if a human being loses his humanity, he doesn't become an animal. He becomes much, much worse than an animal. Much, much more vicious than an animal. Much more wicked than an animal. He doesn't just lose his humanity and become an animal. He's much worse than an animal. And therefore, says Rebellia, what happens when a Jew loses his Jewishness? Does he become a goy? He doesn't. Much, much lower than the lowest of the goyim. A Jew becomes when he loses his Jewishness. Much more degenerate, and he deteriorates much further. That's what a Jew is. And that's what it means when we say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokim, Hashem Echod, we say Hashem is unique in the species of gods. There is a species called God, and there's only one member of that species. That's the Ribbono Nishanayim. Likewise, there is a species called Am Yisrael, and there's only one member of that species. That's Am Yisrael, that's the Jewish people. And then Rebellia goes into a fascinating analysis as to what is unique about the Jewish people. And he says, let's look at our detractors. They point out at some of the unique things. If you want to ask, don't forget this was said in 1939. If you want to understand what's unique about the Jewish people, ask the Nazis. They'll explain to you what's unique about the Jewish people. And so he enumerates some of the factors that make the Jewish people unique. And the one was their azus, their strength of character to the point of being insolent. Their insolence, their cheekiness, and their mesiras nefesh, their willingness to give their lives for something they believe in. Absolute mesiras nefesh. Explains rebellion, although the detractors of the Jewish people, the anti-Semites, say that that's one of the negative features of the Jewish people, but it's not a negative feature. It's a positive feature gone wrong. Because in order for the Jewish people to stand firm in their Jewishness, in the face of all the adversity they've had to encounter through all the years, they have to have such others. They have to have such power. They have to have such cheekiness. They have to have such mesiras nefesh. Otherwise they would never have survived all these years. They've got to be willing to go through all that. But what happens if they don't have their Jewishness? What happens to that middle that's ingrained into their personality? Does that disappear just because they're not observant Jews? It doesn't. On the contrary, that stays with them. So what do they do with it? They use it for other causes. And that's why you could have a Jew leading all these poor innocent blacks to their deaths in Bisha. Mesiras nefesh! Doesn't matter if people die. Doesn't matter if I die either. We're fighting for the cause. You were given that azus to fight for Torah. That's why you were given it. You don't need it for other things. Other things, the battle is much easier. The only battle that's really difficult is the fight for Jewish survival and the fight for the survival of Jewish values. That needs a battle. For that you need Mesiras Nefesh. And the Jew is given that azus, he's given that power and that Mesiras Nefesh to fight the battle of the Ribono Shel Olam. And one of the other things that they consider that are one of our weak points is the fact that we're very ambitious people. And the Rebbe says ambition is also something that was implanted in the Jewish people because of the need to be ambitious for Torah. Without that ambition, where would we learn? Would we teach our children? Would we sacrifice so much to ensure the education of our people the way we have if we weren't ambitious for ourselves? It's true that if we don't focus that ambition on Torah, it will be focused on other things. It will be focused on business, it will be focused on money, it will be focused on power, it will be focused on all sorts of things because the ambition is part of our personalities. That's part of the Jewish person. But the reason the ambition is there is for a positive reason. We've just misused it. And the third example he gives is the fact that only among the Jewish people do we find such hatred of Jewishness among many secular members of our people. You find secular Catholics, they don't hate Catholicism. This one will go to church this one will go to church once a year, this one will go to church once a month, and the Gorfrumbers will go to church every week, but they don't hate Catholicism. Not a hatred for it. You might find an individual here or there, but you don't find whole movements that fight their own religion. You don't find such a thing. Find Christians of other denominations. Stand up for that. But they fight. You find among them people who want the annihilation of their own religion. Never hear such a thing. Buddhists, Shintoists, fighting for the annihilation of their own religion, there isn't such a thing. Only the Jews. Will you find them, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, groups of Jews battling and fighting with Mesiras Nefesh to destroy Yiddishkeit. Only the Jews. You won't find it in any other civilization or in any other culture. And now still the Minister of Education in Israel, mind you. Minister of Education, whose ambition is to destroy Yiddishkeit. That's what she wants. That's what she's fighting for in her entire political life. She's fought for the destruction of Torah. What other nation will you find such a thing? Where else will you find members of a religious group fighting a battle to destroy their own religion? It's weird, it's absurd. And it's not just one person. It's a whole movement. It's a whole group of people. And I've mentioned to you before that it was so ironical. We were in Eretz Israel on the first days of the Intifada. But literally days before the Intifada, and it couldn't have been more than a week or maybe two. I remember being told, I didn't see it on television in Israel, but I was told that some Israelis had been interviewed, young Israeli people, and they were asked if they had to get into a train. And the train was empty, except in one coach there was a religious Jew and in another coach there was an Arab. Where would they feel more comfortable sitting? Which coach would they choose? And the overwhelming majority chose the Arab. And more recently there have been similar statements that are a little bit fiercer than that. It was obvious that the next step the Ribono Shel Olam would bring an intifada, but they haven't learned yet. What are they doing? You would think the result of the Intifada would be for the different groupings in Israel to realize we're all brothers, from not from Haredi, not Haredi. There's the enemy. What has the Intifada done? You dirty frum people and you dirty secular people, let's talk peace with the Arabs. Look what's happened. But the Ribbono Shel'olam brings a message to try and teach us who are our friends and who are our enemies, who's family and who's ois family. And it makes no difference. The one wears payers, the one doesn't wear payers, the one wears white socks, the other wears a khaki kibbutz outfit. At the end of the day, at least you're all Jews. But the result of it isn't to bring the Jewish people together. What are they doing in Israel? The result of it is to elect a new government, more firm in its intention to wipe Yiddishkeit out, and more determined to make peace with the Arabs. What does that mean? Would that same government that's sitting in Israel make peace with the Yidden in Meir Shoharim? Chas v'shalom. Would they make peace with the Yidden in Bnei Brak? Chas v'shalom. Who do they speak about with more veneration? But Yasser Arafat or Lahavdil Rav Shach? Definitely Yasser Arafat gets more respect from them than Rav Shach does. That's what it's done. That's what the Intifada has done. So it will carry on. And it will get worse and worse and worse until we start taking the messages. This is there to teach us who we are and who they are. And we're doing exactly the opposite. The Kiruv programs that are taking place in Israel, the programs of Tumargin, to increase understanding between Jews and Arabs, is there one program motivated from the government side to increase understanding between religious and non-religious Jews? Not one such program. There never has been, and there isn't one such program. To increase understanding between Jews and Arabs? Yes. Funding for universities that will admit Arabs? Yes. Funding for yeshivas? No. Cut it down. What's going on? What's happening? And we sit smugly and we say, look at this wonderful development, Eretz Yisrael, and it's growing and it's flourishing. It's on a path to destruction, to self-destruction. Aren't our eyes open? Don't we realize we're about to destroy this gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam to us? And we sit there smugly, Hashem's given it to us, Mashiach's coming, nothing to worry about. Plenty to worry about. We're about to take it with our own hands and destroy that which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. Unbelievable. Am Echad, there's only one nation. Rebellion points out that none of those are the true factors that distinguish the Jewish people from everybody else. Because you find those same factors among other nations, to a lesser degree. Most of them. This hatred of their own religion, that's something pretty unique. And that also, Rebellia says, is attributed not to something negative. The reason that there's such a passionate hatred for Yiddishkeit is because the Jews are given the capacity for hatred more than anybody else. Because we have to hate deceit. Because we have to hate sheker. There's so much we have to hate Avodah Zorah. There are so many negative things that it is our duty to despise. So Hashem has given us the skills and the tools with which to despise. And what happens when you don't use those skills for what they're meant? When you're busy making peace with the Arabs, who are out to destroy you, you're busy making peace with them, what do you do with your tools of hatred? Turn them against yourselves and destroy yourselves. That's what's happening. So what is the uniqueness of the Jewish people? Let's try and trace it back in this very parasha and see when Hashem says, it's today you've made me special and it's today I've made you special. What did the Jews do in this parasha? What did the Yidden do? If we come back to the beginning of the parasha, they have the Bikurim. What is the Bikurim? Explains Rashi. Adam yoyred letzoich sadehu. A person goes down into his field, v'roye te'ino shebichru, and he sees the beginnings, a first fig, is beginning to be produced. Now, it's difficult for us to understand these kinds of chazals because we don't get excited about things anymore. We only get excited about weird things, things that are very strange and things that are very dramatic. Those are the things that excite us. And as we become more and more desensitized, so we need more drama to excite us. But we see from the halacha that that's not what's meant to be exciting us. You say a Sheikh Yonu. What do you say a Sheikh Yonu? Look at what that bracha is. Sheikh Yonu, v'ki yimonu, v'higi yonu. You say to the Bereshim, "Shem Malchus Baruch Ato Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Shechiyonu, that you've kept us alive, Bekiyamonu, that you've kept us sustained, Behigiyonu Lazman Hazeh, and you've allowed us to come to this magnificent time. What time? Mashiach time? No. Oh, an apple from the new season. What a thrill! We don't get excited by that. We don't get thrilled by that. We don't feel that. We only get excited by very dramatic things, because we're superficial people. But if we would be very sensitive people, we would be excited by the subtle things in life, by the fine things in life, by what it is for new fruit to be produced, the beginnings of a new season, and all that that means, the smells that are in the air, the colors that are around and about, the clearness and the clarity of the air, and the special tastes of those new fruits that one hasn't tasted now for several months, and they begin to come, with all their sweetness, with all their flavor, with all their specialness. And we say, it's meant to excite us. And so now this Jew goes down into his field, and he sees a first fig. And the fig is one of the most luscious and attractive of the fruits. What does he do with it? What is the natural instinct to do with that fig? To pick it and to eat it. First fig. Haven't had figs for ages. To taste it. That's the first instinct. But that's not what he does. Kerech oleho geni, the simon. He wraps a little reed around it as a sign. The emer, and he says, Hareze bikurim. This is for bikurim. This will be brought as bikurim. This is my first fruit. And this I dedicate to Bikurim. What's he saying? We described last night the strange mitzvah of the Somachto b'chol ha'tov, asher nosan l'cho Hashem l'kecho l'vesecho. You shall have joy in all the goodness which Hashem has given you. And we explained last night, and Rashi explained, that this means that the Bikurim can only be brought properly, saying this whole piece that comes before it, at the time that you feel the joy. What is the time that you feel the joy? Explains Rashi. That's the time. Ela bizman simcho me'atzeres ve'ad echog ve'chag, from Shavuos until Sukkos, she'odom melaket tvuoso yufeireso ve'yeino v'shimne. That's the time that a person is busy gathering in his produce and his fruit, his wine and his oil. Aval me'achag ve'elach mevi ve'eino kere. But from Sukkos until Chanukah, you can bring Bikurim, but you don't recite this because there's no more Simcha. That level of Simcha, which is a requirement in order to say the Parsha, doesn't exist from Sukkot until Chanukah. And we explained last night that's very strange, because you could have a man who is in the process of gathering in, but his projected income for the year is going to be 2,000 rand, and you can have another man who has completed the gathering in, and his actual income for the year, all worked out in the balance sheet down to the bottom line, his actual income for the year is 10 million rand. We say the one who is busy gathering in his 2,000 rand has greater simcha than the one who has completed gathering in his 10 million rand. And at first that sounds weird and it sounds difficult to understand how that can be. Surely the man has got 10 million rand, maybe 10 times more than he expected, maybe a million times more than he expected. Surely he's far happier having all that money, realized cash in the bank, than the other man whose projected income is only 2,000 rand, but it's busy coming in. And so we explain that the simcha is dependent not on how much you've got, but on the process of getting it. And we describe the change that comes over people when they stop working. No matter how much money they've got, when they stop working, they start getting quite negative about the future. They start getting quite miserly. They find it difficult to spend money. They sometimes find it difficult to give tzedakah. Money's not coming in. So what if money's not coming in? You can sometimes get a 95-year-old person who's got millions and property all over the place. I remember once as a child, never forget it, I was at the cemetery with my father. He was doing a funeral, obviously, and I went along and I sat in the car and waited for him. On the way out, he gave an old man, whose name I remember, but I won't tell you, a lift. And this old man was saying how hard he's finding things, and excuse me, he has to ask for the lift, but, you know, he's an old man and he's not working anymore, and to buy a car is not easy for him, and I felt terribly, terribly sorry for him. Depend on lifts. And as we're driving through, taking him back to his house, or to his flat, I'll never forget you. That building there, it's mine. That building there, it's mine. Every couple of blocks, that building's mine. That building's mine. And I just couldn't figure this out, but he can't buy himself a car. But it is when a person's retired and he's put his money into investments and he's not actively working, all of a sudden, he feels tight, things are difficult. It's a very difficult situation. Why is that? Sometimes you find people who move from business into a salaried situation. And even if they've got a lot of money, they made a lot of money in their business and they've now invested it, and they're on a salaried situation, they become tight all of a sudden. Why? They don't feel it coming in. And it's not a question of how much is coming in, and it's not a question of how much one's got. When one's in the process of gathering, when the money is coming in, there is a feeling of optimism. It came in today, it will come in tomorrow, and maybe more will come tomorrow. Who knows what will be? But where there's no process of gathering in, when one is not involved in the process of gathering in, there is no sense of optimism. There is no sense of wonder and of blessing at what can still come in. Everything is very, very defined. It's when the insurance companies learnt this chazal that they started their investment policies. In the old days, you remember how it used to work with insurance. You used to put so much in and they tell you how much you'll get out. That's it. Now they tell you, we don't know how much you'll get out. Could be anything. Who knows? If we'll project a 13% growth, this is how much you'll get out. But it might be 15%, might be 18%, might be 22%. And that makes the person feel much richer than if they would say it's going to be 22% and that's it, finished. And feel as long as there's a chance, who knows what it can be. It can grow, there can be all sorts of things can happen. People like to be involved in a sense of potential growth. When there's a sense of potential growth, there's a sense of optimism, there's a sense of determination, there's a rosy future. When there is no potential growth, when things are absolutely defined and limited, one loses that sense of optimism. The simcha of the samachta b'chol ha'tov is that joy of knowing one is in the process of collecting, one is in the process of gathering, and there's more still to come. And we explained last night that what the simcha really is the realization that there's more to come. That's the exciting part. The realization that what I've got is only a part of the whole, that there's much more to come. And where is it coming from? It's coming from the Ribono Shel Olam. And how much has the Ribono Shel Olam got for me? Limitless. As much as he wants to give me, there's no limit. If I start seeing my income as being dished out by the Ribono Shel Olam, and that there are no limits, that's simple, that's joy. Whether I'll get it or I won't get it depends on how I daven Rosh Hashanah, how I daven Slichos, how I behave as a Metshuva, and all sorts of other things depends on, who knows? But the potential, the fact that there is limitless potential in all areas of life, that's something wonderful, that's something wondrous, and that's the V'somachta b'chol ha'tov. That's understanding, enjoying Kol HaTov, all the goodness, what you've got and what you haven't got. Because the Nosem, because Hashem is the one who's giving it. And if Hashem is the one who's giving it, you know there's plenty more where it came from. If a human being would be giving it, you know it's limited. But with Hashem giving it, you know there's plenty more where it came from. And we explained last night that that's the pshat in Ezehu. Oshir HaSameach B'chelko. Who's a wealthy person? Somebody who enjoys, they translate it, who enjoys what he's got. But we said that's not the correct translation. The correct translation is who enjoys his portion. Meaning that he realizes, normally that means I enjoy my portion even though it doesn't include your portion. Just what I've got. But that's not what it means. What it means is, Hatsamad Bechelko, a person who realizes that what he's got is only a chelek, it's only a part of the whole. And the whole is much, much bigger. And there's a potential that he could have more of that whole. That's in the hands of the Ribono Shel Olam. But what he's got is not limited, it's not complete, it hasn't been ended. What he's got is only a chelek, it's something much, much bigger. And he feels himself a part of an eternity. He feels himself a part of an eternity. It's a different kind of feeling altogether. Like you've got people buy shares in big companies. Or they used to buy shares in big companies. So imagine you buy shares, you buy 100 shares in a company and it costs you 1,000 rand. Big company. And you feel a certain sense of pride, you've got shares in this big company. Would you feel the same pride? How many shares have you got? So you've got a millionth of the shares in the company. But you still feel a sense of pride. How proud would you feel if you had 100% of the shares in a company? Still the same 1,000 rand. But the total value of the company is 1,000 rand. And you get the same income, you get the same 10 rand a year, whatever it is, that you would have got. Would you feel the same sense of pride? No. But the income is the same. And let's say the income would be 50% more. From the big company, you're getting 10 rand a year. And if you invested that 1,000 rand in your own little company, whose total assets was 1,000 rand, and you got 15 rand a year, 50% more, where would you feel more pride? In the big one. Why? People like to feel part of something big, of something powerful, where there's an enormous potential for growth. Now I'm only getting 10 rand, but this is a big company. Who knows what can happen to it? One feels one's part of something growing, one's part of something dynamic. How much more so is that when we feel that we're plugged into the Ribbono Shel Olam? That we've got shares in something that is eternal. We've got shares in something that is infinite. We've got shares in something that is omnipotent. We're part of all that. That's the Somachta B'chol HaToyiv. To realize all the goodness that comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam, to take pleasure and joy in all of that. And with that we can understand a little bit more clearly what this person does, this farmer, when he goes in and he sees this first little fig, and he ties the reed around the fig and he says, Areze Bikurim. What's he doing? What he's doing is he's doing something that's unnatural. The natural thing would be to eat the fig, or to watch the fig for another few days and then to go and pluck it. But he doesn't. Nor does he do something, an act of denial. So he isn't giving in to his natural inclination. His Yetzirah, his natural normal inclination is to eat the fruit. A supernatural inclination, in a sense, would be to take the fruit off and deny oneself. I'm not going to take a neder. I won't eat figs this year. I want to be klivish, as Yitzri. I want to master my Yetzer. As much as I desire it, I'm not going to eat figs. That would be the other extreme. And the third route is to elevate the fig. Instead of denying it, to dedicate it. To dedicate it to some higher purpose. And so he says, Hareze Bikurim, this will become Bikurim. But what does that dedication mean? What is he dedicating really? Is he dedicating the fig? Does the Ribbono Shel Olam eat figs? That's not what he's doing. So what is he dedicating? What is a korban? When he goes and he gets this incredible joy over which he says a bracha at the first fruits, and he says, Hareze Bikurim, what is he dedicating to the Ribbono Shel Olam? You know, just as when you've got money, you can do one of two things with it. You can spend it or you can invest it. It's a difference. If you spend it, you have some immediate gratification, then it's gone. If you invest it, you invest it in something which is there for a long time. So it is with emotions and feelings. You can expend a feeling, and you can have a certain good feeling as you do so, and you can invest a feeling, you can invest an emotion in a way that it lasts, in a way that it stays. What this farmer is doing is, he's using the thrill to enhance his avodas Hashem. He's taking that thrill which he's experiencing and he's dedicating the excitement to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let's do something with excitement. Let me say thank you to the Ribbono Shel Olam with this excitement. Let me dedicate myself to the Ribbono Shel Olam with this excitement. Let me use this excitement in my avodas Hashem. We have another example of that with when Yosef and Yaakov meet each other. Yaakov has thought that Yosef is dead. And he's mourned him every single day for the last 20 years. Yaakov has cried bitter tears over the loss of Yosef. And Yosef thought he would never see his father again. And finally they hear that each other is alive. And Yosef sends chariots to fetch Yaakov. And you can imagine what that journey was. You know what it's like when there's a close person, a beloved person that you haven't seen for a long time, who's coming and you start thinking and he's got onto the plane now and he's on his way now. And he's coming closer and closer, and finally comes the time, and you go out to the airport to meet him, and he's on the way to the airport, and he's in the plane coming down, and finally, until the two people meet in this moment of joy, that's how it is when two people meet. Yaakov and Yosef finally coming closer and closer together, and they meet, and what happens? Vayera Elov, Yosef appeared to Yaakov, Vayipel al Tavorov, and he fell on his neck, Vayeft al Tavorov, and he cried more, on his neck, on his father's shoulder, he cried and he sobbed. What was his father doing? Why doesn't it say they cried on each other's shoulders? What was his father doing? Says Rashi, in the name of Chazal, Aval Yaakov lo nafal atzavar Yosef. Yaakov didn't fall on Yosef's shoulders. Lo nashoku, didn't kiss him either. V'omer Rabbi Seinu, why not? Chazal say, for what reason? Shehayo kore Shema. He was saying Shema, thank you very much. He was busy davening. Fine time to be davening.
All these years you've been waiting for the moment, and here the moment finally comes, and you meet up with your son. Couldn't you have said Kriya Shema a few minutes earlier or a few minutes later? You saw him coming in the distance. What does it mean he was saying Kriya Shema? He didn't suddenly appear. And at that moment he just happened to be davening, happened to be saying Kriya Shema. And it's explained that Yaakov wanted to use the thrill of that moment to invest in a Kriya Shema of the sort that he'd never said before in his life. He'd said Kriya Shema with joy, and he'd said Kriya Shema with Mesiras Nefesh, and he'd said Kriya Shema with feeling. But the joy that he felt at that moment, he'd never felt his entire life before. And he didn't want that joy dissipated. He wanted that joy invested in a mitzvah that would always be there. That's what he wanted. And so he took that joy and he put all that joy into that Kriya Shema. That it should be a Kriya Shema like he's never said before in his life. That's what Harezeh Bikurim means. All that joy that the farmer sees at that first fruit, he invests into the Bikurim. Let me take that joy and say thank you to the Ribbono Shel Olam with that joy. You know, we make a terrible mistake. Sometimes we get a very wonderful gift from people and then we write them a thank you letter. When do we write them a thank you letter? A couple of days later, a couple of weeks later, a couple of months later, after we've cooled off from the thrill of the gift. You can't write a thank you letter when you've cooled off. You can't do it justice. The time to do it is at the very moment that you're at the height of that joy, to take that very joy and invest it in the expression. Then you can say thank you properly. Then you can express that properly. And that's what the farmer is doing. He's not saying, I'll eat the fig, and then tomorrow or the next day I'll say thank you to the Ribbono Shel Olam. No, he says, I'm going to take this very joy that I'm feeling now, and Harezeh Bikurim, that's what I'm going to use in my thank you to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That joy that I feel now, I'm going to dedicate to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a Jewish person. That's a Yid. To take not only his things and dedicate them to Hashem, to take not only his objects and his money and dedicate it to Hashem, that many people do, but to take his emotions, his feelings, his thrills and his excitements and dedicate that to Hashem. That's when Hayyim Hazeh, Hashem Elokecha Metzavcho La'aseh Sachukim Ho'ele Ve'es HaMishpotim. Once you're on that level, now Hashem tells you you can do the mitzvahs. That's what doing a mitzvah means. V'shomarto V'asiso Esom B'chol Levovcho V'chol Nafshecho. Because now you know how to do a mitzvah with all your heart and with all your soul. That means with all your joy, with all your simcha, with all your emotions, you know how to gather them all together and invest them into a mitzvah. Not just the emotions that come from the mitzvah itself, but the emotions that come from external things too, you know how to invest in the mitzvah. The emotions that come from seeing that new fruit, you know how to invest into a mitzvah. The emotions that come from meeting your child after so many years, you know how to invest into a mitzvah. That's b'chol levovcho v'chol nafshecho. And this Hashem he'emarta hayoim, by doing that, what are you doing? By taking the joy of that moment and investing it in the Ribbono Shel Olam, you are saying, liyos l'chol elokim, that there is only one God, that's what you're saying. And that everything belongs to Him, even my feelings. And therefore, v'Hashem he'emircho hayoim, liyos l'ileam sugulo. Hashem has set you aside to be a special people. There's nobody else who does that. There are lots of people who believe in God. There are lots of people who sacrifice to God. There are lots of people who serve God. But there's nobody else who knows how to take their day-to-day feelings and emotions and dedicate that to the Ribbono Shel Olam too. And so it is at this time of the year. We've got to try and reach that kind of level in our Avodas Hashem. And we've got to try and do something a little special, a little more unique than that which other nations can do. And a little bit more different perhaps to that which we've done previously. And that is to be able to take our feelings, to be able to take our emotions, and to invest them in a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur. To be able to invest them in the davening. To be able to invest those feelings in the slichus that we're going to say just now. That's what it really is. We see it so often in the Torah. We see it with Yitzchok giving the bracha. Remember when Yitzchok wanted to give the bracha to Esav, and he sends Esav out to go and hunt and bring him a good meal. Yitzchok wanted to take the joys of that meal and invest that joy and that pleasure into the bracha he was giving Esav. It's the physical things that we need to take, the physical pleasures of life, that we need to breathe right deeply into us, into ourselves. We need to open ourselves to them and take them in and then elevate them and dedicate them to the Ribbono Shel Olam in an understanding, a recognition of Him being the source of all that bracha, of Him being davening, so that davening lives the way Yaakov Avinu davened when he met Yosef. Taking that joy and all the tzar, he put all his 20 years of anguish into that Shema as well. He put the contrast between the anguish and the resolution of the anguish. And that was the Hidol, that was the thanksgiving. And he put that thanksgiving in. And we too have to take the tzar, we have to take the suffering that we've had and the joys that we've had, and we've got to put them together. And the difference between them is the gratitude. And we have to see the tzar we could have had and didn't have. And we've got to see the joys that perhaps we didn't realize that we had and see how joyful they really were. How many joys we miss. We don't realize what a Sheikh Yonu is. We just go through it in a routine sort of way. We don't even realize that it's a reason to be happy, that it's a reason to have simcha. And we've really got to take all of these joys, all of these simchas, all of these human emotions, both the good ones and the tough ones, and put them together in the words of the davening. As we recite those words need to ignite something in us that arouses something in us, that causes us to express to the Ribbono Shel Olam our inner feelings. Not to go through a routine of reciting words from a page. That's not a davening. That's not a davening for the whole year, so it's not a davening. It's certainly not a davening for this time of the year, and certainly not a davening for Rosh Hashanah, and not a davening for Yom Kippur. Not to go through those routines, but to be able to actually feel the davening that comes out. My daughter played me a tape of one of the modern singers who imitates all the other singers. He imitates you. It's Karl Blach, and he imitates Mencion Schenker, all of them. And one of the people he imitates is Yosele Rosenblatt. And I was listening to that, and the truth is it was the best imitation. In terms of imitating the voice, it was the best imitation. But I was trying to figure out, why is it that when you listen to Yosele Rosenblatt, you start crying, and when you listen to this, you don't, you laugh. But maybe the reason you laugh is because you know it's an imitation. So I tried very hard to listen to it without any thought of the imitation. This is Yosele Rosenblatt. Listen. And it was like a beautiful utensil, a beautiful vase that had nothing in it. Because when Yosele Rosenblatt doesn't, that's his whole neshama coming out of the davening. All his suffering, all his anguish, all his joy, all his aspirations, and not just his, but those of Klal Yisrael, because of the Shliach Tzibur. There's such richness. There's a real human being with real feelings, and those feelings are just boiling over, they're just bubbling over, and you're a recipient of it all. You feel it all. It's so enriching. Whereas the imitation was just an imitation of the form, but it had nothing of the content. And we need to be very, very careful. That's part of the difference, perhaps, between the old Chazonim and present company excluded, the new Chazonim. Chazonis is not an entertainment business. It's not there to make people feel good, and it's not there to make the time go fast, and it's not there to get people into happy, clappy moods. That's not what it's all about. It's there to show people what davening can be, to show people what can be put into davening and what can be gotten out of davening. We don't have chazonim anymore. So we have to be our own chazonim. Each one has to put into his davening as if he's the chazon, as if he's expressing every ounce of the emotions within him. When we finish each session of davening between now, at least between now, let's try it for between now and the end of Yom Kippur. We'll worry about later afterwards. But at least between now and the end of Yom Kippur, when you finish the davening, if you're not sweating, if you're not completely drained, you haven't done it right. It hasn't been okay. You've gone through everything. Take it, fill it off, you go. What's it all about? That's not a davening. Each word should be able to bring us to tears. Each word should be able to bring us to joy. Each word should be able to bring us to that unbelievable emotional contrast of tears and joy at the same time. Every word, never mind every sentence, never mind every paragraph. And some of us understand the davening a bit better, and some of us understand the davening less. Doesn't matter. Each one understands enough to be able to feel something. And even if one doesn't, you know what's going on. It's okay, one can feel something. And it's a time where we have to not only feel, but we have to express those feelings with everything we've got, aloud, openly, just to allow it all to come out not just to ourselves and not just to one another, but to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, so that we can take all these emotions of the past and all these aspirations of the future and combine them and focus them on the events of the davening over the coming days and over the coming weeks. So that as we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, we can say it with such beauty, with such depth, with such emotion and with such feeling that the Ribbono Shel Olam cannot do anything but declare in return, Umi ki amcho Yisrael. Who is there like the Jewish people? Goy Echad Ba'oretz, a unique species of nation, the only ones that can take emotions and feelings and dedicate them to me in that way. That's the uniqueness of Am Yisrael. And in that there will be a bonding between ourselves and the Ribbono Shel Olam. He is unique as a God, and we who are unique as his people.